Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Shakespeare and Company, and thank you for turning out in such great numbers on this rather gloomy autumn evening. I don't know if it would be right to say this is kind of appropriate weather for some of the
dark and stormy night.
Indeed. Yes. We haven't quite reached that yet, but maybe later. We're delighted to be joined by Fiona Sampson tonight. In 1818, a novel was published anonymously in London. It was a book of such imaginative depth, such insight and daring, that it's still being reread, reconsidered and reinterpreted 200 years later. It told the story of a young scientist who created a sapient creature in his laboratory, only for the creature to escape into a world horrified by its very existence. That book, of course, was Frankenstein, or The Modern Prometheus. Its author was Mary Shelley, trailblazing literary genius, daughter of the union of two firebrand writers, wife of a romantic poet, and the circumstances of its composition are perhaps as well known as the story it contains. But how much do we really know about the woman herself? Fiona Sampson's In Search of Mary Shelley endeavours to get to know the person behind the myths. It's a task made difficult by the fragmentary nature of Shelley's surviving correspondence, as well as an enduring tendency in biographers and literary historians to diminish the role of women in history. And yet, it's a task Fiona Sampson rises to with gusto, weaving a compelling and empathetic portrait of Mary Shelley as a writer, but also as a daughter, as a sister, as a wife, and crucially as an independently minded woman, born into a time when that independence may have been extensively philosophised, but was generally little tolerated. Fiona Sampson is a prize-winning poet and writer. She's been published in more than 30 languages and has received an MBE for services to literature. A fellow of the Royal Society for Literature and a recipient of many national and international honours for her poetry, she's worked as a violinist, in healthcare and as an editor. The Observer called In Search of Mary Shelley a daringly swift and enjoyably irreverent retelling of Shelley's life. And The Guardian wrote that Sampson is as adept as Frankenstein himself, giving life to a figure who convincingly aches and bleeds. The landscapes and interiors within which Sampson's subject moves are as crisply rendered as Frankenstein's own plane of Arctic ice. While writing in the Sunday Times, John Carey declared, "If we get another literary biography in 2018 as astute and feelingful as this one, we shall be lucky." Please welcome Fiona Sampson to Shakespeare and Company.
Thank you, Adam.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you for being here. And I think we're going to kick off tonight with a reading from near the beginning of
yes,
the biography.
That's great. I'd love to. Thank you. Mary came into the world in as dramatic a way as she continued to live in it. One of the reasons I like reading this extract from In Search of Mary Shelley is because I've become, on the strength of one book, quite passionate about what biography should do. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I think it should do is not fictionalize. So I want to say that every single one of the details in this passage are researched, including the meteorological ones. We know a good deal about the circumstances of Mary's birth in 1797 in an August bedroom in Middlesex on the outskirts of London. We know, for example, that it is nearly midnight on the 30th of August, and that there's a smell of damp countryside coming in at the window on the night air. Attracted by the light, crane flies and moths skitter on the windowsill. The waxing moon is only just half full. A new family, the Godwins, are grouped together at the bed. The healthy baby, who's just been born, is being introduced by her mother, the famous radical writer Mary Wollstonecraft, to the delighted father, fellow radical and philosopher William Godwin. Light from the household's oil lamps, brought upstairs for the tremendous occasion of this birth, concentrates in all three faces, finding them the way it does in one of those studies of the Holy Family by Rembrandt, where lantern light falls out of a tender chiaroscuro darkness onto the family group. Rembrandt's paintings tell us to trust the light because it finds where the action is and is always on the side of the protagonists. And tonight's lamplight gives everyone a healthy glow, even as it covers up less attractive details with tactful shadow. The bedroom is at the top of a smart four-storey townhouse, only recently built in low-lying clay fields just north of London. On farmland to the east and south, ghostly roads have been marked up. A small grid of streets peters out between half-built shells, the bumpy outline of foundations, surveyor's tape straggling between clumps of dock and nettle. In the dark, it would be hard to tell whether these are ruins disappearing into the soil or new structures rising out of it. In the summer of 1797, Somerstown is not yet in the shadow of the still unenvisaged railways that will slice up this northern entrance to the metropolis. Tonight, it remains an aspirational address, the sort of place where respectability can be invented and rehearsed until, with a bit of luck, it turns into security. This is an immigrant area where many inhabitants are learning how to be bourgeois in the English way. Tonight's new mother is, in a sense, herself a refugee from the French Revolution. Mary Wollstonecraft Godwin, who on the August night when she gives birth to her second daughter, Mary, is well known for the revolutionary A Vindication of the Rights of Men of 1790 and A Vindication of the Rights of Women of 1792, has recently escaped France with her first child, Fanny, who was born there. Her husband, William Godwin, anarchist and utilitarian, published the equally influential and similarly radical An Inquiry Concerning Political Justice just 4 years ago. When Mary dies on the 10th of September of puerperal fever, that's to say of infection introduced by a surgeon's unsterile hands, it is an agonising, unnecessary death. The cause of puerperal fever has already been identified by Alexander Gordon, an Aberdeen obstetrician. Quotes, "It is a disagreeable declaration for me to mention that I myself was the means of carrying the infection to a great number of women." So disagreeable is this declaration to the rest of the medical profession that, far from trying out his ideas in case they save lives, they have attacked Gordon. In fact, clinicians' continuing resistance to the idea that they fatally infect women during childbirth will remain so violently entrenched for nearly another century and a half that it gives its name to the more general phenomenon of knee-jerk resistance to new knowledge. The Semmelweis effect is named after Ignaz Semmelweis, who, over half a century after Mary Wollstonecraft's death, will be confined to an asylum for pointing out the fatal connection between poor hygiene and maternal mortality. William Godwin doesn't care about the thousands of other women who will continue to die because of clinical arrogance. He cares about Mary. During the 10 days that she lies dying, he sends for 4 different doctors and consults several more. But in the era before antibiotics, there's nothing with which to fight the septicemia as it takes hold. And this is no gentle fading away. It is a bad death. Both Mary Wollstonecraft's daughters will struggle with circular, claustrophobic feelings of depression in their adult lives. What must it be like for a child to grow up in the house where her mother has died, to pass the door of the death chamber on the landing every day? Perhaps Wollstonecraft's daughters open it sometimes and step inside, looking around at the smallish, ordinary bedroom. Do they expect its banal bed and dressing table to communicate something? How can such big meaning be crammed into such a domestic space? And does this upper floor room become the, quotes, solitary chamber, or rather cell, at the top of the house and separated from all the other apartments by a gallery and staircase, that the younger girl will grow up to imagine as a workshop of filthy creation? Mary will be just a teenager when she produces this claustrophobic description of the scientist's workshop in Frankenstein. A couple of pages later on in the novel, she uses a similarly claustrophobic chiaroscuro in that famous focus on a catastrophic fictional nativity. Quotes, "With an anxiety that amounted almost to agony, I collected the instruments of life around me, that I might infuse a spark of being into the lifeless thing that lay at my feet. It was already 1 in the morning. The rain pattered dismally against the panes, and my candle was nearly burnt out when, by the glimmer of the half-extinguished light, I saw the dull yellow eye of the creature open. It breathed hard, and a convulsive motion agitated its limbs." This is the very same technique as Rembrandt's. But here, The details are guttering candlelight catches on, the window panes, the dull yellow eye, seem better suited to a deathbed than to a birth. Rembrandt's paintings use a portrayal of light to affirm their protagonists, create a sense of something shared, and invite us in. Mary's chiaroscuro works the opposite way. It seems to ask us to look, yet also to look away.
We can already see in that extract the seeds being sown in a way in Mary's life for what was going to become the novel, the story she was going to tell, her most famous story. But before we start talking more about Mary's life, I'm fascinated by something you said before you started about the fictionalizing that is often common in biographies and that you resisted. I'd just like to talk a little bit about the origins of this project. The origins, firstly, of your interest in Mary Shelley, what provoked you to write this biography in the first place. And also to perhaps to expand a little bit on the title, which I think intrigues people immediately, In Search of Mary Shelley, because it implies, I guess compared to a lot of biographical titles, it implies a certain humility. It's not Mary Shelley found. Indeed, about the quest. So would you just be able to talk a little bit about the origins of this
project?
That's
fascinating. Thank you, Adam. Yes, in fact, well, where shall I start? I didn't want to reconstruct who Mary Shelley might be. I wanted to find what we could know about Mary Shelley. And I felt torn because on the one hand, I'd been wanting to write a literary biography for a long time, but I would never have had the hubris to go for Mary Shelley. The commission came to me because I'd done an edition of Percy Bysshe Shelley's poetry for Phoebus, the Poet to Poet series. And in doing that, had tried to make sense of the very scattered aspects of his thought, tried to find some uniting principles, tried to find the kind of thinking person at the centre of those thoughts in a short introductory essay, but also in the poems that I chose. And I wanted to do the same with Mary. I felt she's a romantic. The romantics, of course, they're the second generation romantics, but they are the two generations who suddenly start making man the measure of everything. So they are very interested in, they're not just interested in their reactions to everything and the nature of their experience in a kind of anecdotal way or an egotistical way, although sometimes, frankly, one could interpret some of their behaviour that way. they're interested in it because they really feel that after the death of God, you know, they're atheists, this is, you know, man is the new measure of the universe. Man is the, as it were, the meter rule from which everything must be measured. And so, as a result of that, they do a lot of talking about themselves. And although you're absolutely right that all Mary's juvenilia and all the writing, all her letters, all her correspondence until she left home, until she eloped, has disappeared. Probably, I think, lost in Paris, actually, but we'll perhaps come to that.
So check your attics.
Yes,
so
check your attics. She and Percy and their friends and Mary's parents wrote a lot, and they kept their letters and their journals. They thought they were very important. They saw themselves as changing Western society. They saw themselves as philosophers in action. And so they wanted to keep all this evidence. And so I wanted to find the Mary Shelley who was hiding in plain sight. I didn't just want to have this kind of, there she's like a blip on a radar screen, she's here, now she's there. I wanted to put together in a commonsensical way, I know that's a really risky term, what we can know about what it would have been like to be her. And as a result, I did a lot of kind of showing my working. So there's a lot of saying, well, it could be this or it could be that. But the balance of probability is, or further evidence suggests. And the title is part of that, I think.
And I think one thing connected to the Romantic era and what you were just talking about, this sort of this new quest once God has been essentially killed off. I one thing that comes across in the early chapters particularly is a sense of what a radical time they were living in. And I guess in a sense, what a different time it was for us, because I think often when we sort of project back into the past, we don't sort of think of them as moments as being particularly turbulent because everything has kind of been set by historical hindsight,
yes,
in a way. And just this, there were a couple of things. Firstly, that this sense of the Romantic period, where sort of this whole European culture and history was in upheaval. But also another moment, an observation which really fascinated me, where you talked about, you said that it was a time before nostalgia. And the nostalgia you were referring to, I think, was the sort of the Dickensian nostalgia, this idea of an England. And there's sort of a smallness, almost kind of a village sort of identity applied to sort of bigger space. But could you just talk a little bit more about the particular historical context and the particular sort of the turbulence?
Yes, absolutely. Another really interesting question. I think I really dislike costume drama and, you know, men in puffy shirts and women in frocks. I think that is so far from allowing us to inhabit those lives and those the grain of those experiences. I think that Mary wasn't a bystander, but she was aware, but certainly later in life, there's a very painful journal entry where she talks, where she's taking stock of her life when she's in her 40s, and she says, and she's been held to account actually by a man, by Trelawney, for not writing enough about the rights of women and so on, and not being radical enough. And she says, why can't I do this? She says, in effect, my gift is not for it. I can't do philosophy. I can't do political philosophy. But I also think that she wasn't, and she was aware that her parents did, that they were these great, this pair of great influential political philosophers. But I also think that she wasn't just a bystander, because I think actually she was a political philosopher. I think they all were, because they took the risk of living their lives in new ways. So their philosophy was kind of philosophy in action in a way. And it was kind of impure philosophy in the sense it was applied philosophy. So I think you could say that she's an example of someone who practiced applied political philosophy in a way. So they were very Europhile. They were obviously very Francophile because they were all in love with the French Revolution. A great irony one can't help feeling, given that Percy and Mary through Percy lived off the fact that Percy was an aristocrat, in other words, lived off his inherited money and precisely the privilege that they were so glad to see swept away in France. And indeed, one of the reasons they came to Europe was because they'd become politically controversial. It was risky for them to stay in Britain. This is in 1818, actually. So Mary wasn't really around to see Frankenstein come out and become successful. But it's also cheaper in Europe. And of course, they are bringing their English aristocratic income in order to live cheaply in picturesque places in actually Italy at that stage in their lives. And there's a kind of doublethink going on there, which I think is, I don't want to say it's characteristic of a kind of moment of initiative, a moment of having your idealism and not having to kind of ploddingly sort it through and follow the idea through to its conclusion, which you would have to do if you were, I don't know, Hobbes, for example, as I'm taking an anachronistic example. So, yeah.
You used the term about Mary being often being cast as a bystander. And I think, in a sense, given the childhood she had, given the family she was born into, of these two incredibly radical, incredibly well-known writers, I guess it could have gone one of two ways. Like, she could have been entirely swamped by the reputation of her parents. But at the same time, there must have been these expectations on her shoulder that the kind of the progeny of these two minds must carry their ideas, their philosophy, their achievements further. And her childhood, I guess quite a banal thing to say, but incredibly, the events of her childhood, let's say, rather than the atmosphere, seem to be incredibly formative on her character, particularly the death of her mother at quite a young age.
I mean, it's very interesting about the expectations because, of course, Wollstonecraft had another daughter, so Mary's half-sister, Fanny, and Godwin had another child, had a son. So you could have thought the burden of expectation would be shared out. But I think Mary took it upon herself because she was clearly precocious. She learnt to read young. And when she was young, her father was very proud of that.
I think it's a real paradox if you are brought up to excel at revolution, because my instinct, actually, perhaps my researched instinct, is that Mary was a good girl. Mm-hmm. That's absolutely fundamentally what she was. She was a good girl. She sort of wanted to be top of the class. It was a family class. And to be top of the class and be a good girl meant to be revolutionary. So it meant eloping with a married man and running off to France and so on. And I think that she couldn't understand that the people around her didn't read it that way. Indeed, she couldn't understand that her beloved father, whose idea she was following through by doing that, he was explicitly in Political Justice making the case for, you know, the abolition of marriage along with other traditional forms of social organisation, would not then speak to her until Percy made an honest woman of her by marrying her. So I think she was tremendously, not naive, but sort of literal-minded, and she was possibly even a bit of a geek. I think she was intellectual, serious, and she was surrounded by these big personalities who took risks which also suited their emotional ends. And I think there was a real, you know, there was a real friction there. And perhaps that comes out, as you say, in her novels.
And not just surrounded, obviously, by the big minds of her two parents, but it was sort of there, the Godwin household was sort of a carousel of these sort of these
Absolutely.
Great names at the time, particularly because he was publishing.
Coleridge, as well as Blake, you name them. Sir Humphrey Davy.
The first reading of The Ancient Mariner.
Yes, exactly. Hiding behind the sofa. But the family's reading of Coleridge comes to read the Rime of the Ancient Mariner. And interesting that Coleridge thought that she was extremely, she and Fanny, so Fanny's obviously older than her, were too well behaved, were sort of, you know, half dead in their good behaviour. But then, of course, Coleridge's son was extremely badly behaved, so, and hyperactive and kind of like a bit of like a spoiled hippie child to death, I could say.
You mentioned, in a way she was perhaps a bit of a geek, and there was one, I mean, the book is full of these sort of small details about her life, which you don't necessarily sort of project from to some big sort of personality trait. But the one that fascinated me was when I think she was about like 14, 15, she came home from school in Scotland and she was wearing this tartan dress, which she was seen particularly attached to.
Yes.
And we sort of obviously speculate about what her attachment to it was.
Yes.
But there's just the image of the young Mary Shelley almost as a kind of William Wallace
romantic figure
charging around London at the time.
And it's very funny because Thomas Jefferson Hogg, who was Percy's sort of closest friend at that stage, they'd got sent down from Oxford together for the defence of atheism, and Hogg himself would hit on Mary a little bit later as he'd hit on Percy's first wife. But Hogg, writing 40 years later, sort of says he remembers his first sighting of Mary. He says, she's wearing a tartan dress, an unusual costume in London at that time. And that's an understatement, I think. It's kind of that, and that sort of awkwardness of the 15, 16-year-old not quite getting it right, but, you know, coming back from Scotland and being full of probably revolutionary ardour because she didn't get on with her stepmother and she was having to work in the family bookshop and didn't like doing so and felt herself to be an intellectual and above serving in a shop. And so you could feel that this was a kind of revolutionary act. Or perhaps she simply thought that it set off her colouring. Who knows? I mean, you know...
But that's another thing which mustn't be forgotten as well, and is that, you know, she said when she was 15, 16, so when she eloped with Percy, she was 16. And I think we sometimes have a tendency when we project back into history and say, well, you know, things were different then, people grew up differently, time. And yet, I think there is a sort of a broad universality. Like, there's only so much experience you can cram into 16 years of life.
Absolutely.
And I think we tend to forget that when looking at a figure like Mary Shelley, that she was essentially a teenager.
She was a teenager. I couldn't agree more. I think that, of course, one mustn't, you know, be anachronistic. But you're right. There was a limit to how much experience she would have had. She was a 16-year-old. Okay, she'd been sent away from home for sort of 3 years of her teens for her health. First her finishing school in Kent, and then she'd been sent to Scotland, hence the tartan. And actually, she didn't really enjoy Scotland. But, I mean, you know, despite the fact that they were an unorthodox revolutionary family, she would have been pretty heavily policed. There would have been a limit to how much she could have done of anything. And then she runs off with a married man who has one child and another one on the way. And goes to France. And I think that you can see her immaturity in her choice to take her stepsister with her. Of all the bizarre things you would do, that when you're eloping, you take another attractive teenager with you. It's not a great plan. But you can sort of feel that because she hesitated. She went backwards and forwards on the actual day when the carriage had been ordered for them to sort of ride post haste down through Kent to Dover to get a boat across the Channel. She hesitated. And you can sort of sense that feeling that perhaps she felt that if she took, as it were, part of her family with her, it just wouldn't be so scary. It wouldn't be such a step into the unknown.
Is there a possibility, do you think, that Percy encouraged the extra companion too?
I think Percy did encourage the extra companion. And that's not just speculation. This is the joy of research. Because when Percy eloped with his previous 16-year-old, that was Harriet, whom he then married, he tried to persuade her sister to go along too. So there's a kind of pattern of triangulation. Mm. And when he and Mary and Mary's stepsister, who at that stage was called Jane, but would later become self-styled Claire Claremont, got across the Channel through a summer storm, they were pursued by Mary's stepmother, who was therefore, of course, actually Jane's mother. And stepmother tried to rescue her own daughter from, you know, having, you know, her name sullied, becoming a fallen woman, tried to get her to come back before it was too late. And Jane was talked out, OK, yes, fine, I'll go home. And Percy talked her out of it. He took her for a walk on the sands and fed her a line about, you know, but this is so noble and revolutionary and revolutionary France. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, he was very keen. And what's more, while they were in Paris on their way to form an ideal community in Switzerland, which was their plan, he wrote to his first wife and said, why don't you come too? Mm-hmm. So I think that Percy, yes, definitely had a hand in it.
One of the joys of reading the biography is that, I mean, there was a lot of drama in Mary's life anyway. And yet, I think probably partly as a result of Percy, maybe also Mary herself, in addition, there was a layer of melodrama as well. I mean, you mentioned just the Channel crossing.
Yes.
And I just love, there's this wonderful sort of juxtaposition between their journey across the Channel, which is storm-tossed and, you know, their ship is almost wrecked and it's almost catastrophic. Mm. And the journey, as you mentioned, of her stepmother across the Channel. And they essentially arrive at the same hotel at the same time. Mm. But there was sort of like this, I guess, romantic.
Yes, exactly. With a small and large. Yes, this kind of failures of judgment all round. So that Percy and Mary and Jane, as she is then, hire a fisherman's boat to go across at night. We must get across tonight. And it takes them hours and hours and hours because they get caught in a storm and they nearly drown. It's a small boat. Whereas the stepmother, Mary Jane, comes across in the packet. So she comes across, as it were, in the equivalent of the ferry and has a much smoother crossing, much shorter crossing, and arrives at basically the same time in Calais. So, yes. And they've also galloped across Kent and Mary has been motion sick in the carriage, which suggests to me that it could be that she's already pregnant. But I mean, this is one of those places where I'm showing my workings but not saying I think she was.
Mm. Just concerning Percy himself, I think it's fair to say he does not come off well in the book.
No, he doesn't.
He seems to be, at the very least, a source of continuous chaos and continuous melodrama in the life of Mary. But also, there seems to be an incredibly egotistical side to him as well. And a lot of his, let's say, a lot of his desires are justified, philosophized, to the, not necessarily to the detriment of the young women he surrounds himself with. But he's usually. Yeah. And were you, in your research, were you broadly surprised that this was the Percy you found?
No, because I think that, you know, I think that although Percy's reception might be that in some way it was good that he did those things, the mere fact that he did them, the mere fact there's a kind of trail of women and children who don't survive sort of surrounding their escapades suggests a problem. But I think that Because I started off by working on Percy, I think I'm more generous than some of you think I've been to Percy. Mm. That's to say that I think that he may have been perfectly genuine in his self-absorbedness. I don't think he was cynical and calculating. Uh-huh. Or at least I don't think I discovered any evidence. Mm-hmm. But then, of course, I wasn't close reading him. I was close reading her life. But I think it is perfectly possible to make a case for Percy Bysshe Shelley as someone who's, you know, the heir to baronetcy. He's been to Eton and Oxford, okay, got sent down. He has probably been in many ways spoiled in his life, though he had a reputation as eccentric, even at school. His father tried to have him confined to an asylum during his teenage years, so it's been a little bit controversial. But that's a bit of a loner. But he's full of excitement, maybe even a little bit manic, possibly even a tiny bit bipolar, or sort of on that spectrum, very able to throw himself into things and not quite able to think through the consequences, very much living in the moment, and possibly very much sort of convinced and supported in his belief by the people around him that he was a great genius, and in a sense anything that could keep the current of the genius, of the currency of genius kind of flowing, was a good thing. I think that required him to be quite resolutely idealistic and quite really determined not to look at the evidence around him. And I think that towards the end of his life, he was actually setting up a scenario. He was trying to get permission from his friends to leave Mary. Mm-hmm. That's what I actually think, because one of his last letters to Edward, with whom he drowned, Edward Williams, says, you know, the trouble is I need someone who understands me. And Mary, from too much domestic contiguity, doesn't. She doesn't support me. And so in a sense, it's involuntary. Mm. Poor me. Mary has failed me in the way that Harriet failed me. Mm. And it's possible that belief was genuine. Mm-hmm. That's me at my most generous towards
person. One aspect where it's difficult to be generous, and I think it's not something you say explicitly, but sort of, and you mentioned it a moment ago, the deaths of their children.
Yes.
His reaction, we don't get a great insight into it, but it's sort of,
He doesn't seem to mourn, does he?
He doesn't. He's, no. It's not, we don't know that he was specifically callous, but he seems to get on with his business of the deaths of his children.
Exactly. I mean, maybe this is one way in which, you know, other times, other manners, that people did lose many children in those days, and maybe it was regarded as kind of women's business more, and maybe men kind of chose not to get too attached to their kids until at least they survived infancy. Maybe there was all of that going on. You know, babies often went out to wet nurses. There was particularly for the, you know, people who were from the upper classes, there were nurseries and nursemaids and governesses and so on. So there was a kind of degree of a detachment, which, of course, Mary couldn't have because she'd given birth to them and they were her babies. But even so, you know, he writes after the death of William, who is the second of the children. He's the third of their children to die, but the first child only survived after birth a fortnight. So he's the second of the children that they've formed a deep relationship with to die. And he basically is writing again to friends, you know, saying, you know, Mary's so depressed, why can't she pull herself together? Yes, I mean, there's something there that's very hard to understand. There's something there in person that I can't understand at all. And you know.
And whereas the impact on Mary, I mean,
she becomes depressed, doesn't she?
But also, this is something which in her life, because you talk about, obviously, like being the child of a woman who died as a result of complications in childbirth, and then going on to lose several children. Mm. It's in a way, it's maybe an easy conclusion to draw, but it's no surprise that she becomes interesting when it comes to the moment to write this novel.
Well, it's also interesting, isn't it? Because, of course, Frankenstein, by the time she writes Frankenstein, she's lost her first child And she's had her second child, she's got William, and she is pregnant with and gives birth to her third child, Clara, while she's writing Frankenstein. But she hasn't yet lost William and Clara. That happens after they leave in 18. It happens after the publication of Frankenstein. But it's sort of prophetic in a sense, isn't it? The sense of, yeah, of the possibility of things going tremendously wrong. That the proximity of life and death, I mean... Yeah.
Maybe we should hear the second reading now. This, I'll let you introduce it.
Well, we thought that I'd also read some passages about the summer of 1816 and this is the sort of myth of origin of the Frankenstein, the novel. So it's fitting that the next scene, the most famous tableau of Mary's life, is set indoors and at night. She and Percy are in the drawing room of Villa Diodati, on the shores of Lake Geneva. The lighted salon seems to float among the dark trees of a hillside high above the darkened water. It is June 1816, and they are visiting George Gordon Byron, 6th Baron Byron, at the house he's rented for the summer. Claire, who's trying to prolong an affair she's been having with the peer, is once again in tow. Also in the room is Byron's young doctor and gentleman's travelling companion, 20-year-old John William Polidori, who is himself an aspiring writer. But this is no idyllic summer evening with a scent of roses and cool drinks on the terrace, for 1816 is a year without a summer. The eruption in 1815 of Mount Tambora on Sumbawa, in what is for now still the Dutch East Indies, has filled the Earth's upper atmosphere with volcanic ash, blocking out the sun and creating a volcanic winter. Across the world, average temperatures are 1 degree centigrade lower than usual, and the anomaly is significantly greater here in Western Europe, a region that is coincidentally already suffering food shortages caused by man-made catastrophe in the shape of the Napoleonic Wars and the British Corn Laws. Nevertheless, Mary is enjoying herself and goes exploring as often as she can. On the 1st of June, she writes home to her half-sister Fanny with a mixture of boastfulness and frustration, quotes, "An almost perpetual rain confines us principally to the house. The thunderstorms that visit us are grander and more terrific than I've ever seen before. One night we enjoyed," and she underlines enjoyed, "a finer storm than I had ever before beheld. The lake was lit up, the pines on Jura made visible, and all the scene illuminated for an instant, when a pitchy blackness succeeded, and the thunder came in frightful bursts over our heads amid the blackness. In short, it was a dark and stormy night." And it's to the accompaniment of this glorious cliché that the Godwin-Shelley household and Byron's often meet in the evenings at Villa Diodati. On one such evening, most probably the 16th of June, Mary, Percy, Claire, Byron and Polidori gather to read ghost stories. It's nearly the longest day of the year, but the strange darkness of the skies mean lamps have been lit earlier than usual. The book they're reading from is an anonymous French translation of 10 German ghost stories, Phantasmagoriana. I was just wondering whether to read you this detail, actually. The stories it contains are no brief transcriptions of folk traditions, but have been worked up in contemporary literary style as part of a German fashion for the shower roman, the shudder or horror novel. Today, a similarly gifted and highly educated house party would read these stories to howls of laughter and set themselves writing pastiches. These young romantics do not. To our contemporary imaginations, the horror in Phantasmagoriana appears very stately. But as genre fiction, its stories balance between populism and the literary. Everyone present at the Villa Diodati has grown up with the related genre of the Gothic novel, An English Invention. But the party at the Villa Diodati have turned to European writing for their thrills. The shower roman is altogether darker in tradition. It combines medievalism and the supernatural, most often through stories about necromancy, whose themes of raising the dead are rich in foretastes of the contemporary science of galvanism and fashionable questions about the origins of life. So it's not surprising that "We will each write a ghost story," said Lord Byron, and his proposition was acceded to. This is according to Mary Shelley's account. The trouble with a writing challenge is it produces as much anxiety as inspiration. Polidori feels left behind. Mary claims that she is the last to start. Quotes, "Have you thought of a story?" I was asked each morning, and each morning I was forced to reply with a mortifying negative. Poets themselves are less anxious about the whole thing. Byron begins, quotes, "a tale, a fragment of which he printed at the end of his poem of Mazeppa. It's an Orientalist story set around the death of a mysterious Englishman, Augustus Darvel, in a Turkish graveyard near Ephesus," which doesn't get as far as the hard work of unravelling the story it sets up. Percy starts a story, quotes, "founded on the experiences of his early life." It's intriguing to speculate what such experiences, if not fictional, might have been. He's recently disclosed to Polidori that, when he was at Eton, his father tried to have him incarcerated in a lunatic asylum. And there's something else. Galvanism is still very much part of the zeitgeist. And the principles of life, as Polidori calls them, are a theme of the summer. The Doctor's Diary for the 15th of June, the night before the Phantasmagoriana reading and Byron's ghost story challenge, records the conversation that Mary will later claim is so influential on Frankenstein. Polidori says, "Afterwards, Shelley and I had a conversation about principles, whether man was to be thought merely an instrument." In Mary's version, Byron replaces Polidori. She says, "Many and long were the conversations between Lord Byron and Shelley, to which I was a devout but nearly silent listener. During one of these, various philosophical doctrines were discussed, and among others, the nature of the principle of life. Perhaps a corpse would be reanimated. Galvanism had given token of such things. Perhaps the component parts of a creature might be manufactured, brought together, and endued with vital warmth." So much, so philosophical. But right to the last, I think, it's the Gothic that hangs in the fog of that strange summer, like a Brocken spectre. And I think that famous passage where the creature comes to meet Frankenstein to denounce him is very redolent of a Brocken spectre. It goes, "He bounded over the crevices in the ice, among which I had walked with caution. His stature also, as he approached, seemed to exceed that of a man. I perceived, as the shape came nearer, sight tremendous and abhorred, that it was the wretch whom I had created."
Thank you so much. Now, I'm very conscious there will be questions from the audience, but I think before I hand over to you, I would just like to talk specifically about the book, Frankenstein, the impact it's had, the enduring impact it's had. Yes. Just as a quick aside on the section that you wrote, the 16th of June seems to be a very sort of significant date
does,
in literary history.
Yes.
But that, I mean, obviously the conditions of the conception of the book were quite dramatic. And you know, you gave us the sort of the climactic conditions, the dark and stormy night. Obviously, there is a sense throughout literary history that when you get a kind of great minds together, and particularly when you get them in competition, and in this case, it's explicit competition as well.
Yes.
Then that can produce great things, and yet still the impact of this story, the influence of this story, the originality of this story, I think is possibly unrivaled in literary history based on the impact it has had and the enduring impact. And I was just wondering, it's such a broad subject, but would you be able to speculate a little bit on on why you think?
Well, I think it's a myth, isn't it? I mean, I think it's got two archetypes, not one, but two. It's got the overreaching scientist, the innovator, the maker, the someone who goes beyond the kind of social consensus, both of what society is comfortable with, but also its ethical consensus. And then it's got the not quite human who's created or simply whom we encounter. I mean, I'm thinking of yetis and so on. And I think both of those speak to our fears. I think they're not quite human, speaks to a very ancient sort of fantastical fear of kind of ghosts and ghoulies. But I think that the overreacher is a really interesting, is really important for us as we have a sense of the modernist sense, the modern sense of society as in progress. I mean, I think they're romantics, but of course romanticism is the start of the modern era. It's the end of relying on God and tradition and therefore what has been handed down as forms of knowledge. And it's the start of humans taking responsibility for knowledge and kind of going forward. And that's a great promise, but it's also a great threat and terror. So I think that it's not just the first science fiction novel. I think it's the first story about modernity. And I think that's why it speaks to all of us, because we continue to live in modernity and we will continue to live in modernity, even if we lose faith with modernity. So I think there's that. I mean, interestingly, as I think about it, I mean, there are parallels with the Daedalus myth. So in the past, humans have worried about the dangerous innovator who goes too far and gives his son wings which melt because he flies too close to the sun, and so on. So it isn't quite the very first time that that story has been told, but in a way it is. And what's fantastic about it, I think, is that myths generally, so for example Daedalus, are oral tradition, and they take a long time to be formed, and they are full of juicy inconsistencies, and they're capacious, and you can read in things into them because they've been read by different societies over different centuries and so on. But Mary manages to do this with something which is invented simultaneously. I mean, she writes the whole thing within a year while moving house and country and helping her stepsister give birth and having another child of her own, and generally having a life alongside. And incidentally, while teaching herself how to write novels by suddenly changing her reading habits to reading novels to see how they're built. So she's doing all of that. And so in a sense, it's read, is given that compression, given anyway, writing a novel in a year is pretty amazing. But, you know, it's a tremendously compressed sort of simultaneous invention. And I think that's an astonishing achievement.
And the character of the creature itself, or the creature, as we sometimes call it, Frankenstein's monster, or as if apparently now it's in common usage, it's fine just to call the creature Frankenstein and get away with it. But it seems to be a literary character that belongs to us in a way, like something that unlike a lot of other literary characters, which we feel, you know, people might do pastiches of, and they might they might write tributes to. Frankenstein's monster, the creature, is something which we take and we reappropriate and we put it into movies and we rework the story and we add sort of supplementary characters. We give it a family. And what do you think it is about this character that the, you know, beyond just really sort of admiring it and respecting it and being fascinated by it, that we feel it belongs to us?
It's odd, isn't it? It has stepped out of the novel and become, we've now got an oral tradition around it, or at least a kind of popular cultural tradition around it. It's not just journalists, it's films, it's as sort of any TV series that's long running will have a kind of Frankenstein homage episode, won't it? And I always say that actually much of the kind of popular cultural reception has only half the myth. It's got the overreaching, the mad scientist, the blue sky research and its dangers, and it hasn't actually got the creature and his tragedy. Mm-hmm. It hasn't got the fact that the creature is really human like us. He feels like us, he learns like us, he wants to be loved like us. He has language, he's better than us, not worse than us. Whereas, you know, we all think about Boris Karloff, to be honest, don't we, when we think about Frankenstein's creature. And in fact, of course, he's not a monster. He's a creature in the novel. So I think it's a shame that we've lost that, because we've lost that sense of the way that the two protagonists pull on each other. And you're never sure in the novel who you really want to identify with and sympathise with. You know, it's a great novel because Mary's very good at making you shift from one, you go along with Frankenstein, oh yes, he's very idealistic, a bit like Percy, he's very idealistic, oh but look at the consequences of what he's done, oh the creature is very idealistic, he's done, oh but look at the consequences of what he's done. There's a great oscillation going on there.
And my final question before handing over to the audience is concerning the rest of Mary's books, because she wrote did. 5-6 novels after this. At a moment, you say none of her other novels quite achieves what you call the living quality of Frankenstein.
And they're better written. That's the trouble. I mean, they're better written according to the lights of her day. They are more literary. I mean, I think a sort of posthumous tragedy of Mary, of Mary's work is that now when we have finally reclaimed her as actually a really serious literary writer, we finally understood that actually the novel wasn't ghostwritten by Percy. It wasn't particularly improved by him. In fact, rather the reverse, his little line edits, which aren't substantial anyway. It is complete. It's not fragmentary. It's not improved by the films. It is its own great work. And so we're ready to read the rest of what she wrote. The rest of what she wrote was rather like sort of Walter Scott. It's in thick, chunky, well-researched, more smoothly written novels that aren't so much to our contemporary tastes. And that's a tragedy because she had some... She wrote historical novels. She wrote the first dystopian novel, The Last Man. She didn't just write the first science fiction novel. She wrote the first dystopian novel. She wrote novels in which there were female protagonists. So Valperga is very interesting. That's a novel she writes, the first novel she has published after Frankenstein. And that's a story about an Italian woman who is the ruler of a city-state, which is invaded by her lover, who is the ruler of another city-state. And if she's going to stay with him and stay alive, she has to renounce her sovereignty. So she doesn't. She sails off to her death. She commits suicide, basically. And that's extraordinarily interesting as a myth too, but because it's a really, it's a 3-volume. Yeah. So it's a tragedy, really. Oh, of course, she wrote biography. She was a travel writer, you know.
And poetry as well.
Yes.
The best, the less said about that, the better, I said.
Well, yeah, it's all right, but yeah.
Okay. Over to you. If you have a question for Fiona, raise your hand. We'll get you the microphone and...
Yes, thank you very much. Relative to what was said about Percy Shelley's constitutional incapacity for mourning, after the death of William in Rome, he wrote a letter back to a friend in England, and he spoke of his misery, and then Shelley was known as a man of impeccable breeding, urbanity, extraordinary politeness. And after giving voice to his misery, all of a sudden he says, enough of melancholy. And to me, he was thinking of his correspondent, that it would have been distressing to his correspondent for Shelley to have related all of this. So that's how I see that. But there was an essay about Shelley, Matthew Arnold. He begins by saying that Mary was back in England. She was thinking of which school she would send her son to, and she consulted with a friend. And the friend said, well, you must send him to a school where they teach him to think for himself. And Mary said, oh, no, I want my son to think like everybody else. And you would say that this is a renunciation of all of Percy's revolutionary principles and energy and being extraordinarily individual. So how do you interpret this line of hers? It seems as if she had resigned herself to absolute conventionality. She had had enough of revolutionary genius.
Yeah, thank you very much. So that's a two-parter, really, isn't it? In terms of the sending Percy Florence, her son, to Harrow, yes, she did. She longed for respectability and to be an establishment figure, really. She wanted respectability. She wanted to be solvent. I mean, one of the things we have to remember is that at the beginning of the 19th century, to be not respectable, particularly for a woman, is to be reduced to penury. I mean, you have to participate in society in order to be able to get credit and pay your bills. And, there's no welfare state. There's no safety net. And particularly for women, and particularly for Mary, who has not only paid such a high emotional price, I think you're right, for her nonconformity, but she has such a bad reputation. You know, it's her baggage always. I think she understood viscerally the very high cost to individuals of trying to change society. And funnily, in that sense, she was mirroring the turn that her father made, because Godwin, when he published Political Justice in 1793, was saying, you know, we must tear down structures, you know, direct action, don't get married, you know. By the time Mary elopes, the grounds, the philosophical grounds on which he rejects her elopement are that, you know, the individual can't do it. What you have to do is, you can't as an individual overthrow society. You can only publish the arguments and create the discourse so that society as a whole will change. And frankly, I think that's common sense. So I think, in a sense, Mary made the same turn. In terms of Percy and his urbanity, Urbane, I think, is probably pushing it a little bit. I think he was very attractive. I think that he was very charismatic. I think he was very good company. But there's certainly a sense that, particularly, has episodes in public. I mean, for example, he has an episode in that summer of 1816, and he also has some episodes shortly before he drowns, which are basically psychotic episodes. So in the summer of 1816, the group, so Byron and so on, they are reading Christabel, and Percy suddenly shrieks and runs out of the room and says that he thinks that his Mary's nipples are eyes that are staring at him. One might say that he's had an insight in that she can see through him, but that would be too glib, so I'm not saying that. But, you know, shortly before he drowns, so they're in staying in this rather gloomy, only just converted monastery right by the seashore, and again he's having terrible nightmares and rushing to Mary and rushing to their friends for consolation. So I think that Urbane, in the sense of the sort of social control that it implies, will probably be not quite it. I'm sure you're right that, you know, there was a convention at that time. You couldn't talk too much about the deaths of children, because certainly Godwin was very hard on Mary when she grieved the deaths of her children. Said, you've got to pull yourself together. No one's going to want to know you if you're gloomy company. So obviously there were social conventions, but I think there was also a readiness to get on with aspects of his life. I mean, particularly after the death of Clara, not so much, you know, perhaps William, where, you know, William died of typhoid and they were all there, you know. It was different death, really. I think Percy was more implicated in Clara's death, so. Thank you.
Any more questions? Don't be shy. Well.
Oh
yeah, gentleman there.
Seems to me that Byron comes off quite well, actually, in comparison with Percy in your novel.
Yes,
What were their relations? Were they competitors? Were they brothers in arms? Did Percy look on Byron slightly older
and more successful.
As a father?
Yeah, it's a great question. Thank you. Yes, I think it's not a novel, by the way. It's a biography. I'd love to write novels, but I can't. Yeah, I think that Byron does come out of the story of how he treated Mary. He may not come out well from other stories, but he was that bit older than Percy, not old enough to be a father figure, but he was successful, kind of world famous, you know, world famous in those terms. That's to say, you know, people who read books in Europe had heard of him. So, and he was a star, and he was a well-known hedonist. And he was also more of an aristocrat and richer than Percy. So he was in every way he outshone Percy. But he found Percy entertaining and interesting, liked his ideas, his vegetarianism and so on. He didn't try vegetarianism, but for the summer of 1816, he found Percy interesting. But he always seemed to respect Mary. Mary became his, in a sense, his first reader, his fair copier, as she was for Percy. And that isn't an exploitative thing. That's a thing that, you know, obviously writers do to each other, a kind of intimate, respectful thing. He never tried it on with Mary. And he continued that relationship after Percy had died, unlike most of their other friends who basically dropped Mary like a hot potato because, you know, she wasn't with her, you know, great company husband anymore. He'd gone, and also because he'd been sort of setting her up for this, in a sense, although he didn't know who's going to drown, by going around behind her back saying, you know, she was really not being supportive and so on. She was being cold to him and so on. So, but Byron didn't bother with all that. He remained loyal to Mary. And Mary, in a sense, remained loyal to Byron too, because she befriended Byron's last lover, who otherwise was rather ostracised. So, she, you know, it was a kind of two-way thing. I think she, yeah.
Did he see her as a replacement for Ada?
No, I don't think so. But I think that he therefore had the notion of bright women and wasn't threatened by them. And yes.
I think that's probably all we've got time for, actually. But do stick around afterwards. Have a glass of wine with us. We have plenty of copies of this wonderful biography available at the Till. I imagine Fiona would be happy to sign them.
I'd be glad to.
For you, if you pick one up. Just out in paperback, I think, maybe.
Just out in paperback
this week.
3 days ago, so, yeah.
So, pick up your copy at the front. Stay around, continue the conversation with each other, with Fiona. And please join me one more time and just say thank you to Fiona Sampson.